Accession number 6380, rule number 1.
Sir John Colville, reel 1. Could I start off by asking you, Sir John, the circumstances in which you first became an assistant private secretary?
I was in the Foreign Office when the war started, having been there 2 years, and I wanted to go and join my brother's regiment in the army. And Sir Alexander Cadogan, who was the head of the Foreign Office, tried to dissuade me. I had every right to go because I was just under 25, and 25 was a reserved age. However, they bribed me not to by making me junior private secretary to Mr. Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, at 10 Downing Street, and that was such an exciting possibility to be right at the centre of the war that I felt I couldn't refuse it. So I went to 10 Downing Street in end of September or early October 1939, and then when the government changed in May 1940, I was more or less taken over with the furniture. I was a junior private secretary, and I was the one who had not been connected in any way with Munich or appeasement or anything like that, although in fact I was a strong, and still am, a strong believer that Munich was absolutely right, and a point I used to argue with Winston Churchill in subsequent years.
What was the comparison between Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Churchill? Did you enjoy working with Mr. Chamberlain?
I admired Chamberlain because he was a man of tremendous integrity and determination, but I must confess he lacked charm and he lacked warmth. It wasn't really until right towards the end of his life, when he was a dying man, that I suddenly began to see a glimmer of what I'm sure was there, which was a really rather wonderful character and personality. But as his private secretary, and indeed all his private secretaries, we really shared in no way in his family or private life. I mean, we none of us ever went down to Chequers, and the relationship was very formal. He was a very good boss, and perhaps I can tell you one story which shows that. I became his junior private secretary at almost exactly the same time as Burke Trend, subsequently Secretary of the Cabinet, became junior private secretary to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sir John Simon. After 2 or 3 weeks working at Number 10, the principal private secretary there, a man called Arthur Rooker, who was a delightful personality, gave me a job to do which would be shown to the Prime Minister. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was really, I think, making a précis of a very complicated and difficult paper which the Prime Minister wouldn't have time to read in full. At almost the identical moment, the John Henry Woods, Principal Private Secretary of the Treasury, did precisely the same with relation to Burke Trend. But the difference in the reply was so interesting. My paper, which I wrote with fear and trembling, went up to the Prime Minister and came back the next morning with a comment written on it in ink saying, I think this is a very well done paper. I congratulate Mr. Colville, MC. Now, I don't think it probably was a very well-done paper, but it was Neville Chamberlain trying to show confidence and give encouragement to his junior private secretary. Burke Trend's paper came back in the morning torn into 4 pieces without any comment. And that is the difference between Neville Chamberlain and John Simon. Now, Winston Churchill liked young people. Of both sexes. He liked young men, he liked girls, and he always took a great deal of trouble with young people. To give you an example, quite a different thing for myself, but at various periods in the war, I was impressed by this. I remember once I think it was the King George V, on a battleship, and Churchill, although he was very much burdened by events at that time, spent a whole hour going down to the gun room to talk to the midshipmen, all of whom clustered round him and asked him all sorts of questions, and he treated them exactly as if they were his equals. In fact, they forgot he was the Prime Minister and Minister of Defence. And he did the same when his annual visit to Harrow, his old school. He used to go after the concert, he would collect round him all the senior boys and talk to them for half an hour, three quarters of an hour, an absolutely charming way, so that they all were deeply impressed. Now, Neville Chamberlain could never have done that. And equally, his relationship with the younger members of his staff, and perhaps for some reason rather particularly myself, I'm not ever quite sure why, except that I think he was fascinated that somebody should want to leave him and go away and join the RAF. He became, I think I can say, rather fond of me, and for that reason. But he, when I was alone with him, driving down in the car somewhere, or perhaps occasionally lunching alone with him at Chequers, because we all of us went to Chequers all the time, with one private secretary each weekend, one would have arguments with him. I particularly remember one argument about the merits of Munich, and one really forgot one was talking A to one's boss and B to the Prime Minister, and let fly and gave all one's arguments. And he never minded a bit. He would talk to one absolutely as man to man, as if you were a contemporary. And that was a remarkable attribute of Churchill, which I think is very rare amongst great men.
When you first heard that the Prime Minister was going to be Churchill, what was the reaction in the private secretary's office? Was it one of a certain amount of trepidation, given
total
his
horror.
Reputation?
A total horror. There was a theory, which was quite untrue, that Churchill had been scheming and planning and plotting against Chamberlain. Now, whatever Churchill's faults, and like any other human being, he had some, he certainly was never an intriguer. It wouldn't have occurred to him to plot against his boss. I think that, who was the Prime Minister, I think that possibly some of his more enthusiastic supporters may have tried to encourage the Daily Mirror, for instance, to run articles against the Prime Minister, but never Churchill himself, and never, I'm sure, with his approval. However, there had grown up at number 10 a feeling that he was irresponsible. We all knew about Gallipoli, about the support for the White Russians, Archangel and all that, about the return to the gold standard, which in those days was thought to have been a disaster, though nowadays a lot of people think it was really rather a wise move, and all that kind of thing. And there was a general feeling that he was a man who was irresponsible and who would go in for wild and undigested schemes. This wasn't just number 10. It was very much the feeling in the cabinet offices, people like Sir Edward Bridges and General Ismay. And one must remember that he was held responsible in Whitehall circles for the failure of the Norwegian expedition. He had indeed been very enthusiastic about it. It was not, I think, a very well planned or coordinated operation, and its total failure was held to be the fault of the First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill. So he arrived at number 10 with a wall of suspicion. Now, most the two senior, or one of the senior private secretary, departed and went off with Chamberlain, and he brought with him two of his secretaries in the Admiralty. The remarkable thing is that we all got on extraordinarily well together. There was never any friction. New people joined us in due course, John Martin, Leslie Rearn. I was, of course, the only one who'd been there, apart from Anthony Beaver, who was responsible for the patronage questions. As a matter of fact, I was responsible for patronage questions up till the autumn of 1940. But the principal private secretary, a man called Eric Seal, came to see me one day and said that he thought it was no reflection on the proposals I'd made about appointing bishops, but that he did think my hair was a little not quite grey enough to do that. I was, after all, only 24, and that Anthony Beaver had better do it. But then he added rather nicely, but I think in a way you are more likely to be successful in dealing with the Prime Minister than Anthony Beaver. And that indeed was true, because I did get on with him very well, and I think Anthony Beaver was rather alarmed by him, anyhow, to begin with, though he became very fond of him. So there we were with a gathering of four men. Finally, it used to be three, but became four, and one woman, Miss Watson, who was who'd been there since the time of Bonner Law and Lloyd George, and we were the private office, plus a man called Commander Thompson, who was a sort of flag lieutenant that Churchill brought from the Admiralty, and whose only job was to arrange journeys abroad, who took no part in the in either political or administrative affairs. And his one or two outside advisors and friends, such as Lord Chauvel, Brendan Bracken, and Desmond Morton. We all got on extraordinarily well. There was no friction at all in the private office that I remember the whole time, well, the whole war, or the only periods I was there. It was a very, very happy ship indeed. The Prime Minister was incredibly inconsiderate as regards ours, and he was, I think, without being a selfish man, because he was very generous, he was enormously egocentric. And it never occurred to him that what suited him or what he wanted might be extremely inconvenient for other people, whether they were his colleagues in the cabinet or his staff. But despite all that, and despite some silly things that have been said by certain biographers since, he was deeply loved by everybody at Number 10, from the junior typist right up to the principal private secretary. He was held in the greatest affection. I'll give an example of that. Sir Horace Wilson, whom Churchill didn't approve of, although he kept him on as Secretary of the Treasury, but he ceased to have a room at 10 Downing Street, as he had in Chamberlain's time. His secretary, Miss Davis, was a very outspoken and marvellously honest and straightforward, but sometimes rather ill-tempered, Welsh lady, devoted to Horace Wilson and violently anti-Churchill. She became, in due course, one of Churchill's most greatest admirers. But this was interesting because she started with a really very, very strong antipathy. And to get over that and to become, as she did in the course of two or three years, a really devoted admirer was, I think, a tribute to Churchill's personality and the way he could win people over who had started by being hostile.
How much actual say does the Prime Minister have in the appointment of his private secretaries? Is it totally up to him? Because you stayed on, I see, but others left.
Well, private secretaries, and that included Miss Davies, I was just talking about, are civil servants, and they do what they go where they're posted, and as far as that is concerned. The Prime Minister, of course, must select his own staff. In at the beginning of of hostilities on May the 10th, 1940, he had really other things to think about rather than look at me. He had his two people from the Admiralty whom he knew, Eric Seal and John Peck. Beaver was rather banished into a back room, and he didn't really have time to look at me. But as the years went by, I think he did take considerable interest in, well, because obviously the personalities of his private office were important to him, because people he was going to see every day and at weekends. He became very choosy in his second administration between 51 and 55, when I was his principal private secretary, and had one or two minor personnel problems there, because although he never said he disliked anybody, it was quite clear sometimes he didn't think one particular man was appealed to him.
Yes, I've always heard this stories about Churchill as being very attached to people that he knew, and that certain men were often advised that if possible they should do their job without coming into contact with the PM, because he preferred the faces that he knew.
Yeah, he did. Of course, that was one of his weaknesses in some ways. I think in a book I wrote something, I said that the call of Auld Lang Syne was very strong with Churchill, and he did make several appalling appointments, such as Sir Roger Keyes, who was a disaster as the director of combined operations, merely because he named them in the First World War. And he was inclined to say, oh, yes, I knew so-and-so, and try and appoint them to some job. He did it again in his second administration when he brought back Woolton and Lubbers as overlords, and they were both admirable men in that time, but they had really had no job to do. And as far as his private secretaries went, that is absolutely true. Once he got used to a face, it became part of the scheme of things, as he would call it. And I know when I went away and joined the RAF in the late autumn of 1941, and a very nice fellow called Francis Brown was seconded from the Foreign Office to take my place. It took Churchill quite a long time to get used to him. When he did get used to him, he became very fond of him, and he became fonder of him still when Francis Brown insisted on going off to join the Coldstream Guards at the time that I came back from the RAF. And anybody who went and did anything military was sure to be enormously liked and admired by Churchill. But then there came the awful moment in another time I went away. I was always going in and out of Number 10, and a very nice fellow was produced to take my place temporarily, but shown to the Prime Minister, who looked at him, didn't say very much, and I won't give his name, but because he had a very distinguished career afterwards. But Churchill rang the bell for John Martin afterwards and said, take him away, I don't want to see him again. Well, that was very embarrassing for all concerned. And then when I went off for 3 months fighting Lee in the summer of 1944, Operation Overlord, again they brought in a young man from the Admiralty to take my place temporarily. And Churchill was, in fact, quite nice to him, but he really couldn't ever get quite accustomed to him. He liked people he knew, and when I came back, no merit of mine, but merely Auld Lang Syne, I mean, I was welcomed with open arms and taken straight off to the Quebec Conference and so on, because it was a familiar face. And it went literally a familiar face. On one occasion, I got, in the RAF, I got all disgusting diseases, impetigo, and from sleeping in infected blankets. And that led to, because they're allied in some strange medical way, to chicken pox. And I was away for 3 or 4 weeks recovering from these two horrible diseases. And as I couldn't shave, I grew a beard and then a moustache. Well, before I went back to Number 10, I was well enough to shave off the beard, but not, I left the moustache, which I rather fancied. And Churchill, I went in to greet him. He greeted me very warmly, but he looked at me oddly. And then he rang the bell, and he said to one of my colleagues, what has happened to Jock Colville? He looks odd. I hardly recognize him. To which they said, well, you may have noticed, Prime Minister, he's grown a moustache. Have it shaved off at once, he said. So I did. But I mean, as I say, a familiar face had to be the same face he'd seen before.
I wonder if we could turn now to the routine of Number 10, beginning with your own personal routine as Assistant Private Secretary.
Well,
this particularly in the period 1940-41, at the time of the Blitz.
Well, it was the same really then and later in the war. We all had our own particular jobs, in a sense. Mine was, of course, I was the only Foreign Office representative in the staff, so all Foreign Office papers and Foreign Office telegrams came to me. I also dealt quite often with some of the defence telegrams and so on, but there was no use or no point in being just a one-man job, except for the patronage side, because we had to take it in turns to be on duty for 24 hours at a time. This is largely because of the Prime Minister's habit of working till 3 or 4 in the morning, and we couldn't all be about. So one private secretary would be on late duty at Number 10, and in order to try to get that absolutely worked out properly, You would then be on duty at 8 o'clock the following morning as well. So, and then of course there were the weekends at Chequers, and therefore you had to know about all the papers in the Prime Minister's box on whatever subject they were. And of course his box, which he worked from, had a lot of folders in it. Some were marked for defence, some Foreign Office telegrams, minutes from General Ismay, replies from General Ismay, and then every kind of subject was in the different folders. And therefore, as a private secretary, you had to know about the whole lot. You couldn't suddenly find yourself at Chequers on a Friday evening, going to be there till Monday, being ignorant of the various papers in the box. So you had to have, apart from your own private employment, and as I say, in my case, largely Foreign Office matters, you had to have a general knowledge of everything that was coming to the Prime Minister, even if you didn't understand it, with the one exception of Boniface. Now, Boniface was what was the decrypts, or whatever the proper word is, of the German Air Force and subsequently naval and military ciphers was called. For some reason, the man who wrote a book about it called it Ultra. Ultra was its name in the Admiralty. But elsewhere in Whitehall, it was always called Boniface. But it's now become known as the Ultra Secret. And that was... I mean, I never heard the word Ultra until that book was published, although I obviously knew all about it. We weren't supposed to know all about it, because those came to the Prime Minister, those signals, in yellow boxes, with VRI on them, because they were very old boxes, used for the purpose, and they were brought by, personally, by Mingis, who was the head of the Secret Service, Brigadier Mingis, and he came in and changed them round. Quite often the Prime Minister didn't look at his yellow boxes, he was too busy with something else, and Mingis would come in, open them, the special key, take away the ones that were out of date or of no value, and would sometimes say, I think there's this box has got something which the Prime Minister should see urgently, and that would be done. Well, he read his yellow boxes, but the great thing about those decrypts, after he got used to them, they were very detailed. They were about the enemy order of battle and that sort of thing, which was of great interest and importance to the Joint Planning Staff, to the JIC, and to the Chiefs of Staff, but not really of immediate importance when it came to the general policy of the war. So that they were less important to the Prime Minister, or indeed to members of Cabinet, I think, than is very often made out. Of course there were exceptions. There was a famous Moonlight Sonata, the Coventry raid. Now that's a curious one. The Prime Minister didn't know anything about it. I think they may have been mentioned by the Chiefs of Staff that there was this big thing brewing 2 or 3 days before. But it wasn't until he opened his yellow box on the way down to Ditchley, somewhere in the middle of Hyde Park, and the car was going down, and read about the Moonlight Sonata thing, that he became aware that there was going to be this big raid, which he assumed would be on London. And he then turned the car around. He had John Martin with him, who was several times testified to this. And I can testify to it because I happened to be on duty at number 10 that weekend. The Prime Minister, to my horror, because I'd been looking forward to a quiet weekend, suddenly reappeared that November day and sent me off to the what he called the Burrow, which was the deep shelter in Down Street, and said, you know, you're too young to die. London is obviously going to be flattened. And then I don't think it was until quite an hour or two after that that it became apparent that the raid was going to be on somewhere like Coventry or the Midlands. He didn't know that when he turned the car around. I'm not even sure that he ever knew until it was or happened, because he certainly went. I remember John Martin telling me, well, I was safe in the Borough with John Peck, my colleague. He and John Martin and the Prime Minister climbed onto the Air Ministry roof, which he used to do regularly during the railroads. He liked to watch the fireworks, so to speak. And he climbed up there to watch it, and nothing happened. This vast bomber force went, I suppose, north of London, straight to Coventry.
I wonder if I could now ask you, Sir John, what was the relationship between the No. 10 staff and the offices of the War Cabinet?
The private office, as Churchill called it, at No. 10, and I should perhaps point out that until Churchill became Prime Minister, the word private office was one exclusively used by the service departments, and particularly by the Admiralty. Before the war, and indeed in Chamberlain's time, the private secretaries at No. 10 were never known as the private office. It was a naval term and came in with Churchill. Their relationship with the cabinet offices was very close indeed, because the two main props of Churchill's way of carrying out the war, conducting the war, were Sir Edward Bridges, Secretary of the Cabinet, and General Ismay. Both of them were secretaries of the cabinet, one the civil, the other the military. And when Churchill wanted something examined, he would send a minute, usually marked action this day, either to Bridges or to Ismay. And so they were constantly at No. 10. And then, of course, in the CWR, during the Blitz, which was the only time we used the CWR, we didn't use it in non-air raid times, they were there the whole time, because their offices were there. And so in the evenings, when we dined in the mess in the CWR, that was until No. 10 had its own mess, which it did after a bit, thanks to Brendan Bracken. But for quite a long time, I mean, down there, and one would go and have a drink there in the evening, one always found all the members, senior members of the of Sir Edward Bridges' staff and of General Ismay's staff. And we got to know them all very well, and particularly General Ismay's, because on Churchill's foreign tours, which he always took one or sometimes two private secretaries, there would always be not only General Ismay, but either General Hollis or General Jacob. And so we got to know them all extremely well, and as a lot of our work tied in closely with theirs, they were invariably having to deal with sharp questions coming from the Prime Minister or from the Minister of Defence, whichever role he was assuming.